Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, a call for more empathy in our politics and how a court settlement may reshape the landscape of college sports. But first, a complaint filed with the State Department of Education on behalf of a student at the Arizona State Schools for the Deaf and Blind resulted in a finding that detailed several instances of noncompliance and a requirement to fix those issues. Amanda Glass, a managing attorney at Disability Rights Arizona, says her office got a call last May from the student's guardian saying the young person was being removed from the school because of an autism diagnosis. Since the student's primary disability was autism and not related to sight or hearing, the school said they could not serve him. Glass says the school acknowledged it hadn't provided some of the services to which the student was entitled, thanks to his individual education plan, or IEP. Those include speech and occupational therapy and counseling services. ASDB attributed that to staffing issues. Glass came by the studio earlier to talk about this case and what it could mean for students going forward. And we started with the investigation done by the State Education Department, and that in her mind, it seems as though the agency did a pretty thorough job of coming up with findings that could help the student.
Absolutely. I want to applaud the Arizona Department of Education for their work in this particular investigation and set of findings that they issued. It is the most extensive and thorough my agency has seen. I have never seen the Arizona Department of Education appoint a special monitor to a case, but they did in this case. So we have been working with our client, the student, and a special monitor on some of the relief that the school needs to provide to him, and it's incredible. I will say that it feels unusual to us. We've never seen something like this before, and we're just not sure why it turned out as well as it did. You know, there may be some other motivation, but our hope is that it's indicative of a sea change at the department that, you know, in light of everything happening federally and changes with the way civil rights laws and IDEA are going to be enforced, that the state is choosing to step up at this time and really take on the responsibility of ensuring that special education laws are enforced for Arizona students.
Do you have reason to believe that this is maybe a change in direction, a new normal for the state?
I would love to believe that. I don't have reason other than this great finding to think that that may be true. And I will say that something that has been frustrating for us as an agency is the lack of transparency in the state complaint process at the Arizona Department of Education. Many other states actually publish these findings and corrective action orders, of course, redacting personally identifiable information for students and possibly even protecting the school's identity, but at least showing, hey, we did this many investigations, we found noncompliance in this many cases, and we ordered this type of corrective action. The Arizona Department of Ed does not do that at all. Although these are technically public records, they're kind of hard to get even with public records requests. I've submitted several on behalf of my organization and not received the data I'm looking for from the Arizona Department of Education.
Even if this is maybe just a one-off, will this case impact other students either at this particular school or elsewhere in the state?
It should definitely impact students at this school. It's a very interesting entity. It's large. It serves about 2,000 students across the state. And the relief that came from this complaint is going to impact all of those students. The school has been required to audit their files to determine if other students, like ours, were denied services because of staffing issues, to have meetings with every single one of those students and their families to determine how are we going to make this right on an individual basis for all these kids. They've also been required to work, as I said, with a special monitor who is providing them with training, helping them adjust some of their policies to be more legally compliant. And I think all of that is going to have a big impact on our students who are deaf, hard of hearing, or visually impaired in the state of Arizona. I'm very happy about that. In terms of other schools or other local education agencies, you know, seeing this and being put on notice or learning from this, I'm not sure, again, how likely that is because this is kind of secret.
Do you have a sense of how many students at this particular school could be affected?
I don't know for sure. Again, there's 2,000 students within the ASDB system who are served. Many, many students who have hearing impairment requires speech and language therapy. Mm-hmm. I would imagine most have some form of speech language therapy because that's going to work on their communication skills beyond verbal speech, but just communication generally. So the fact that ASDB did not have a speech therapist for the 23-24 school year is wild to me. I imagine many, many of the students who were there were impacted at least by that service.
Even with the order, though, I mean, if the school can't afford to hire these folks, does anything change? I mean, if they don't get more money?
It's a great question. And I think, unfortunately, this is the conundrum of my entire career, is I'm holding the schools accountable and saying, this is the law, you must follow it for these students. And the schools are saying, where do I pull from to make that right and get rid of that liability? I will say that schools have insurance through the state. So there's the Arizona Risk Retention Trust that most schools have bought into. So they have some ability to fix these particular issues. But they need funding. I mean, I do think this is reflective of a broader issue, not just in Arizona, but across the country of we talk a lot about teacher shortages, but we also need to think about related service professionals like speech therapists, occupational therapists, counselors. And without those staff available, our students are going to miss out on what they need and the schools are going to be legally in trouble.
So you mentioned the idea of whether this is a one-off or sort of a sea change. I wonder about the importance placed on the State Department of Education now, given everything going on the federal level in terms of the Trump administration's efforts to get rid of the U.S. Department of Education.
Yes. Federally, we know that the administration's aim is to dismantle the U.S. Department of Education, which does play a critical role in enforcing the rights of students, their civil rights, their disability-related rights. What we've heard several times from the administration is send it back to the states. And we are hopeful that the results here are indicative of our state's willingness to step up and take on that responsibility. That is what I'm hoping. I really hope it's not a one-off. I hope that's what this is. I think there are a lot of ways that the state will need to step up beyond this. The state complaint process has existed since 1975 when IDEA was passed. But there are other things that other state departments of education do that ours has chosen not to. For example, enforcing Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act, which is more about discrimination. Arizona's Department of Ed has always pointed to the U.S. Department of Ed and said, if you have a discrimination complaint, that's not us. That's out of our hands. Go to the U.S. Department of Ed. Well, we know with the major reduction in force and possible dismantling of the Office for Civil Rights at the U.S. Department of Ed that that's not really a viable option for families anymore. So if you are experiencing discrimination on the basis of disability, where do you go? And I think it should be the Arizona Department of Education.
What are you hearing from families right now about what's going on both at the state and federal levels and, you know, maybe concerns they have about what all that could mean for their kids?
I think the families that we serve are very concerned about services. We had the huge DDD issue in Arizona this year. Mm-hmm. Talks of Medicaid being cut. The families we serve have students who rely on those supports so much, both in home and there are supports that cross over into school. Schools can actually bill to Medicaid for certain services that are provided. We have families who are calling us very concerned and upset with discrimination complaints. And we used to be able to say, you can file a complaint with the U.S. Department of Ed's Office for Civil Rights. Now, you know, technically, yes, that's still an option, but how realistic is it that your complaint will be picked up and investigated quickly enough for it to make a difference for your child? It's not clear. And so that is definitely not our go-to route anymore, and we are having to explore other means of helping families enforce their civil rights.
That is Amanda Glass, Managing Attorney with Disability Rights Arizona. Amanda, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
As debates rage about the long-term impacts of President Trump's harshest policies on things like immigration and gender, many Democrats have bemoaned what they see as the loss of empathy in American politics. Some pundits have urged patience, claiming Trump supporters will rediscover a sense of compassion when they start to feel adverse effects from Trump's actions. But Slate editor Dahlia Lithwick doesn't think that's going to work. She wrote recently about the lack of empathy on both ends of the political spectrum, and she spoke to my co-host Sam Dingman about it.
this is Trump's superpower, right? I think that we have to be really mindful of the fact that if you have an entire political narrative built up around the idea that your suffering is caused by sort of evil others, whether it's, you know, the Marxists or the communists or increasingly just Democrats, then the idea that they are, you know, taking one to the face becomes really gratifying. And so I think that we have to be very, very careful about saying like, oh, folks are eventually going to be, you know, awakened from this slumber and realize they actually deeply care about the suffering of others. Because I think that kind of cashing in on the suffering of others is the coin of the realm right now.
Well, and you referred to it as Trump's superpower a moment ago. But one of the other things you're talking about in this piece is the array of methods by which he does this.
Right. Well, I think you can do two things at the same time. You can make the outsider, the migrant, Trump would call the illegals. You can make them smaller than they are and also bigger than they are. And you can do that at the same time. Right. And so the image that I was really struck by was Kristi Noem, you know, going down to the Cicot prison in El Salvador and photographing herself in front of these kind of blurred out, anonymized, faceless, alleged gang members, all of whom were deported without, you know, due process or habeas corpus rights or any semblance of a fair hearing. And one of the ways you make that okay is you just make them this completely fungible set of anonymized, half-naked men. And that way you make them, you know, you're not just othering them, you're sort of eradicating them as individuals. And then the other half of that play, and it's very clever, is to make any one of them seem much bigger than they are. They, you know, through the rhetoric, turned Kilmar Abrego Garcia into this nefarious, you know, global sex trafficking, you know, gang lord, which was all out of proportion to the proof that they had. And, you know, again, if they had proof of that, prove it in a court.
Can you talk a little bit about how this is happening on the left?
There's just such exulting, Sam, in the idea that someone who voted for Trump never expected, you know, his workers would be deported and now his farm is suffering. You know, somebody who voted for Trump and now is like, you know, being deported willy-nilly without a trial. The sort of joy, the triumphal joy, I think it's another way of numbing ourselves to actual suffering. And I think that I'm certainly sure that it has no persuasive value, right? I don't think you're going to flip any Trump voter by demeaning and diminishing their suffering. And so they are mirror images of each other. I don't think you get to say, oh, you know, Trump made me numb. Or alternatively, you know, Trump supporters made me numb to human suffering. I think what we need to be able to say is that taking triumphal joy in the suffering of the other is problematic. And we choose to give that away. And I think the other thing that I really wanted to try to capture is that when you are seeing such widespread suffering, it's really easy to go small and say, as long as my kids are okay, you know, as long as my community is okay.
Right.
That is also a moral choice.
Yes, but as you point out, also a conscious tool of authoritarian regimes, right?
I think that's right. And I think you can study any number of, you know, Hannah Arendt and Tim Snyder and Ruth Ben-Ghiat. I mean, everybody who talks about how authoritarianism takes hold talks about these strategies for kind of thickening the membrane between you and the other so that either you're afraid to speak up or you don't even know what's true anymore, right? You're in this fog of war, and so you don't believe anything anymore. And so all you can do is make sure your kids are fed and, you know, you've got your fridge, you know, full of healthy food. And I understand very much that that's a targeted, you know, way to drain people of empathy. But I think we should be very, very aware that it's deliberate.
Yeah, by encouraging people to keep their focus small and intimate and not pay as much attention to things that are happening outside the walls of their homes, it creates a broader lane for the administration to pursue their initiatives, which many people have begun to argue bear a strong resemblance to these autocratic regimes that we've been talking about.
I think that's exactly right. You have a lot of very, very dyed-in-the-wool, serious, credible progressives backing away from robust immigration policies,
right,
and saying, oh, well, you know, maybe, you know, we shouldn't be so generous in our thinking about what kind of country we want to be. Sometimes it comes dressed up as, you know, political savvy, right? Well, this just, you know, support for, you know, trans service members just doesn't poll well, right? Mm-hmm, or, mm-hmm. you know, support for open borders, whatever that means, doesn't poll well. It's absolutely the same impulse, which is pick your battles, go small, convince people that, you know, oh, okay, it's only trans athletes, that doesn't affect me, which is precisely the paradigm being used about it's only, you know, criminal illegals, it doesn't affect me.
One of the things that you're also saying in this piece is that this wearing down, sanding down of our capacity for empathy is not irreversible, that there is, as you put it, a weirdly urgent task. How would you characterize that weirdly urgent task?
I'm just going to say it. It's going to sound flip, but like some of this is really fun, right? It's be in community. It's go to rallies. It's not sit at home alone. It's not surround yourself with kind of toxic, paralyzing news that makes you feel as though there's nothing to be done. You know, there's amazing scholarship about how in some communist regimes, just the act of sitting around in your backyard, just being in community with people becomes a real force for generating a sense of community and empathy. And so I think that we actually know exactly what this looks like. And in some sense, it looks a little bit like some of the No Kings protests we saw recently, which is just, you know, this corporeal, put your body in the street, talk to somebody who you don't necessarily agree with. It's not just teaching yourself, you know, to be powerful and to be a moral agent and to have empathy. It's actually that aggregated across societies, this is how change happens. And so it's not simply that you're kind of working on yourself. It's that if we all do a tiny bit of this, the world changes.
Well, Dahlia Lithwick is a senior editor at Slate and wrote this piece, Americans Don't Lack Empathy, We Are Being Drained of It. Dahlia is also the host of Slate's Amicus podcast. Dahlia, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Sam.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, how do different fabrics keep you cool?
Go to a sporting goods store anytime, and instead of a hang tag on a garment, there's a book with all of the benefits you'll get from this, whether it's antibacterial or cool to the touch or temperature regulating. There's so many good things on them today.
We'll continue our series on shade with a conversation on the science behind cooling fashion. But first, a federal judge earlier this month approved a settlement that resolved a few antitrust lawsuits that had been filed against the NCAA and the so-called power conferences. Under the terms of the settlement, there will be a new revenue-sharing model for the next decade that will allow universities, for the first time, to directly pay their student-athletes. For the first year, schools will have $20.5 million to distribute. That number is expected to go up over the next 10 years. The settlement also includes nearly $3 billion for Division I athletes who are not allowed to sign name, image, and likeness, or NIL, deals. This represents a big change for college sports, and with me to talk about that is Victoria Jackson, a sports historian and co-director of the Great Game Lab at ASU. And Victoria, let me first ask you about your reaction to the settlement and the new era of college sports it's led to.
It's historic kind of in two ways. It's historic in that it's a settlement. We've seen many, many antitrust challenges and kind of an increasing number of them in the recent past. And with all of those cases, the decision by the defendants, the NCAA and the conferences, has been to fight. In this case, they chose to settle. So that makes it historic. And then the other way in which it's historic is that this is the first time schools have agreed to pay for play. You know, they have increased the benefits and monies going to athletes in response to these previous antitrust cases, but this one is explicitly pay for play. So that is new and distinctive and historic.
In your mind, does this make college sports more like professional sports?
Yes, particularly with top of pyramid football. So when I say top of pyramid, what I mean is the power conferences who are required to opt into this settlement. And then any sort of school that is aspirationally trying to make it into that top of pyramid. So schools can opt in if they aren't mandated to do so as a member of the power conferences. And we've seen some conferences opt in and some schools opt in as well.
So you mentioned top of pyramid football, and I wonder how you see this sort of trickling down to other sports. I mean, obviously football and men's and women's basketball are sort of, you know, one in 1A, you know, at the top of the food chain for sports in terms of revenue. But like, how might this impact baseball and softball and track and field and swimming and diving and water polo and all the other sports that colleges offer?
There's two main parts to the settlement, and that also makes it two main ways that those other sports are affected. So the first is that the settlement sets up revenue sharing, and there's a cap placed on that revenue share. When anytime you cap anything without collective bargaining, you're kind of vulnerable to antitrust challenges. So now we're seeing an effort to get Congress to codify the settlement. But that first part with the revenue share, it's capped in the first year at $20.5 million per school. That's across all sports. The damages class, the back pay, is broken up in a clear kind of percentage with the heavy majority going to football, upward of 75%, another 15 to men's basketball, around 5 to women's basketball, and 5 to all other sports. So when we're talking about track and field, when we're talking about water polo, when we're talking about lacrosse, there is, in most cases at most schools, not likely going to be revenue sharing with those sports. But the other main part of this settlement that will affect those Olympic sports is that we have, as part of this settlement, roster limits replacing scholarship caps. Mm-hmm. And depending on the university, this might be an expansion of scholarship opportunities. So, you know, since I am a Sun Devil Athletics person and an ASU person, I'll use us as an example. We've committed to increasing, actually, the number of scholarships we offer across our sports teams, more than 200 new scholarship opportunities, which under the old NCAA rules before the settlement would have placed us in violation of NCAA rules because we would have been going over those scholarship caps. For example, baseball, old rules, 11 and a half scholarships. Now it's 34 of a roster limit. So we can scholarship more athletes, but have less athletes on the roster now because a lot of Olympic sports had walk-ons. And so the overall number of participation opportunities in those other sports will actually be coming down unless schools get creative around what a participation opportunity constitutes.
Yeah, I'm curious about that because one of the big holdups in this settlement was the rules around roster limits and scholarships. It sounds like maybe in some ways it's been alleviated, but in some ways maybe not.
This is what I love about the federal district judge who oversaw this settlement, Claudia Wilken. And she made very clear in the final hearing on the settlement to the NCAA and conference lawyers, you need to resolve this roster limits thing, and maybe you should consider an opportunity to grandfather in athletes who are already at universities on teams or who have been recruited to play for those teams who are, you know, seniors in high school. That those schools can go above the roster limit and grandfather those athletes in. And she made that clear, but then, you know, the settlement, when it was sent to the lawyer after that final hearing, did not have that included, so she rejected it, which was pretty bold. Sent it back and reminded them of what she had made clear to them Earlier. And so instead of mandating that those athletes will be grandfathered in, it's been made optional. That said, I think schools should get creative around what participation opportunities are. I wrote a piece for my friend Matt Brown's College Sports newsletter called Extra Points, that schools should bring back junior varsity. And that's a workaround for roster limits. And if this is scholastic sport, which it is, it's Olympic development, it's scholastic sport, it's big time college sports, it can be all things at once. Why don't we lean into that scholastic part of it and bring back JV? And you know, if you have an athlete who's maybe underperforming or underdeveloped while they're in high school, and they, you know, put in the work and they grow and they develop as an athlete on that JV team, they have an opportunity to move up to the varsity. And that I see as a roster limits workaround.
At the end of the day, do you think this settlement is a win for the student athletes? I mean, or at least some of the student athletes?
Dealing in the environment in which we're in right now, I think it's a step forward. I don't think it is creating optimized policy. What we have is many different industries operating under the umbrella of college sports. I think optimized policy would be an exploration of whether or not that top of pyramid football should be spun off. I think optimized policy would be allowing those other sports to have kind of sport by sport policy determining what serves those athletes in those sports best. I think we have to come up with new subsidization models for college Olympic sports and also think about how best to serve athletes in kind of broad and robust Olympic development, but also with an eye toward maximizing participation opportunities. The other thing I think college sports could do a better job of is serving community, not as spectators, but as participants themselves. And if we lean into the mission of higher education to serve community in the intercollegiate athletic space and think of our community members as athletes too, I think that also opens up new doors to new subsidization models where we're not so dependent on football money to support all of the other sports offerings we have in our university systems. So it's a yes and no. Yeah. This is better than what we had before. I don't think it's optimized policy.
All right. That is Victoria Jackson, a sports historian and co-director of the Great Game Lab at ASU. Victoria, great as always to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mark.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. When a Navajo woman was invited to attend a friend's church in Gallup, New Mexico, she was so offended by what she saw, she decided to record it. It was a play which depicted, among other things, a traditional Navajo healer killed and condemned to hell for practicing his way of life. The woman posted the video on TikTok with the caption, "The things you see in border towns." Shandine Silversmith has written about this. She's the Indigenous Affairs reporter for the Arizona Mirror and joins me to talk about it. And Shandine, one of the things that struck me in reading your piece was that while the woman who recorded the play was outraged by it, she also didn't seem terribly surprised that something like this would happen in this community.
So I think one of the things a lot of people don't understand is that Gallup, New Mexico is a border town. And it borders not only the Navajo Nation, but the Zuni Pueblo Nation, but it's also the closest town for a lot of other tribal nations. So it gets a lot of traffic who are indigenous. It relies on a lot of indigenous people for their customers, for people to come through, but it hasn't been a friendly town to indigenous people. There is a history of violence and racism in Gallup, New Mexico, and a lot of people are aware of that. But for what particularly happened at the door, the Christian Fellowship Church, is this young Navajo woman, she expected going in there kind of to experience a service that she grew up with, you know, whether it's worship, prayer, or scripture reading. What she didn't expect was a full, like, theoretical production of a play showcasing how a Dene Hatakli, a Navajo medicine man, would be condemned to hell for practicing his traditional Dene ways. So for her, it was very shocking. And honestly, when she talked about it with me, she was like, it was disturbing because a lot of the people in the audience were themselves Native, and the people who were putting on the play themselves were Native. So she said it was as if they were comfortable or used to seeing that kind of production.
Well, it sounds like for this person especially, there was almost two levels of disturbance. One, what she saw on stage, and two, as you just referenced, the fact that so many other Indigenous people in the audience and performing seemed okay with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's exactly the type of disturbance that it was. But I feel like the main point of disappointment and... I'm not a religious person, and so I can't really speak to what that would mean, experiencing that, because you grew up in a religious household or like you have actively gone to church. But I feel when she witnessed that and she saw it disregarding Dene ways of life, and the fact that the play showcased this Dene Hatakli, this medicine man, being killed and then ultimately being condemned to hell, I feel like that's a different level of disregarding what an entire population of people's way of life is.
What is the relationship between Christianity and the Navajo Nation? Because as you write, you spoke with a researcher, a historian, and she counted a very pretty high number of Christian churches in these border communities like Gallup right around the Navajo Nation.
It's not uncommon to travel around the Navajo Nation and see churches set up every few miles. I mean, I grew up in Steamboat, Arizona, and my commute from Steamboat to Window Rock is like an hour long, but within that drive you do see several churches in between communities and then within communities. So it's prevalent. Christianity is very prevalent on the Navajo Nation, and one of the interesting things that Danette Dale talks about is that you have a lot of our former leaders and a lot of leaders on the Navajo Nation now who are Christian. So it's really hard for a lot of Dene people to say they're not Christian because of how embedded Christianity is within the Navajo Nation. So when she talks about that, she's like, it's hard because you have people who grew up in Christianity and you have people who actively see Christianity across the Navajo Nation. So when you have Navajos who openly say they're not Christian, they are. It is often hard to admit that, but the Navajo people still have their own traditional knowledge and ways of life that are like deeply rooted in Dene values and philosophies that Dene people follow. So it is that just balance of those two viewpoints.
So what kind of reaction and response has this gotten from either the church or the city of Gallup or, you know, Navajo Nation officials themselves?
So the church has not responded. They have not put out a statement acknowledging it or apologizing or reaching out to the young woman who recorded the video or even reached out to the tribe, at least not that I'm aware of at the moment. So the only response that the community has seen has come from the Navajo Nation Council. So the Navajo Nation speaker, Crystalline Curley, she sent a letter to the church asking them to kind of let's sit down and talk about this. Let's go have a discussion about why this is disrespectful and this depiction of our traditional ways of life is not okay. And one of the main points that Curly wanted to make when she announced that she sent this letter is that she didn't do this just out of nowhere. She consulted with traditional practitioners. She consulted with local pastors and local faith leaders before they sent this letter, because they wanted to make sure that it was open to having this conversation, for them understanding that you are neighbors to the Navajo Nation, and we have people who visit the Gallup community all the time. We have people who visit your church. But she said when she consulted these individuals, many of them expressed their disapproval for the church's performance, and noting that it does cross that boundary of disrespecting faith. And that's the only response that I've seen so far. And when I myself reached out to the church and its affiliates, I never got a response.
And is it safe to say that Speaker Curley has not heard back from the church, as far as you know?
As far as I know, they have not.
All right. That is Shandine Silversmith, Indigenous Affairs reporter with Arizona Mirror. Shandine, good as always to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Recently, we've brought you a number of conversations about the importance of shade. And if there's one constant in those conversations, it's that there's just not enough of it. Thankfully, as cities try to find innovative ways of creating more shade, clothing companies are also getting creative. Deborah Young is a professor of textile science at ASU, and as she recently told my co-host Sam Dingman, one of the best ways to stay cool in the summer is to choose your fabrics wisely.
Temperature regulating, cooling, and heating is hot right now. We've got so many ways to do it. I mean, historically, we relied on particular fibers. Some fibers are cellulosic fibers, which means they come from a plant, and that's like cotton and linen and bamboo and those kind of fibers. They just naturally are absorbent. And absorbency has a cooling effect on the body already. Taking that perspiration away from your body makes a difference. However, they hold that moisture. They absorb the moisture and they hold that moisture. So Gen 2 was adding wicking. And the celluloses don't do that as well. That's why the synthetics have really taken a huge role in that field today.
What is the difference between wicking and the absorption that those organic fabrics do?
Really good question. So absorbency takes the sweat off your body, but it holds it. Wicking doesn't bother to absorb. Wicking just takes the moisture from your body to the surface for evaporation. So it just gets rid of it. And that has a much better cooling effect, and faster, actually. The sweat evaporates. That by itself creates a cooling effect. And that cooling the skin causes you to stop sweating. So it's a really efficient system.
Wow. And so these synthetic fabrics that are able to do this, what is it that enables them to do that in a way that something like linen or bamboo can't do?
So the big synthetic ones, of course, are poly and nylon, and they have taken over the athletic market entirely for these reasons. They are hydrophobic, which means they don't like water. They don't absorb. So it sort of bypasses that absorbency, and the fabrics don't get wet. They just get rid of water. And there's lots of trademarks that you can find. I'm sure you Dry Fit by Nike or Climacool by Adidas. And it did start in athletic wear, but it's now in bedding. It's huge in bedding. I, for one, have invested in cooling bedding.
Interesting. So how would this work in a bedding scenario? Is it a similar thing where the mattress wouldn't hold the sweat moisture?
Exactly. You don't want it under you, and you don't want it on top of you either. So then we can move into, if I may, let's move into the next section, which is even more exciting and innovative. And that is PCM, which stands for phase change materials.
Okay.
And these are literally textiles that will change their state from a liquid to a solid, which means they will regulate your temperature. When you're hot, it will cool you. When you're cool, it will warm you. Really good in sheets if you're one of those sheet flippers at night.
Yes. So how does it do that? This is making me think of back in the 90s, I remember all the rage was hypercolor t-shirts, which would change color?
Change color with temperature. They're coming back again, I think.
Oh, they are. Okay.
Hypercolor, exactly. You touch it and body heat would leave that handprint behind.
Right. So
it was very interesting. So it was thermal sensitive. And that's what's happening here too. It's temperature regulating. It's body heat sensitive. So it absorbs, stores, and releases your heat to maintain a comfortable equilibrium. My husband always says that I have a short tolerance. 3 degrees is what I want to live in, a 3-degree range. If it gets below the 3 degrees, I'm turning on the heat. If it gets higher, I want the air conditioning.
Yeah.
He's not wrong.
So is the idea behind these phase change materials that it would be sort of all weather sort of gear, like it would be shirts you can wear whether it's hot or cold outside, pants, jackets maybe?
That's the idea. I don't know that I'd go from the desert to the snow with them.
Sure.
It's such an exciting field today. Just body comfort, body temperature regulation.
It sounds like something out of science fiction.
It does. But the things that I'm talking about are not still on some drawing board someplace. They are available. Go to a sporting goods store anytime, and instead of a hang tag on a garment, there's a book with all of the benefits you'll get from this, whether it's antibacterial or cool to the touch or temperature regulating. There's so many good things on them today.
So these phase change materials, is this technology that makes these garments kind of expensive right now, or could we find them, you know, on the rack at Target, say?
I think they're everywhere, but people don't understand what PCM means.
Right.
It's just one of the things they add. It's like a cooling gel pillow. There is one more that I wanted to address, and that's HiQ. H-E-I-Q, HiQ Cool. It's very interesting because it combines two technologies, and that is cool to the touch, which will literally lower your body temperature just because of the touch that you're in. It's like being in a cold room will lower your body temperature, and it has a PCM in it. So HiQ is not as common, but it is available.
What issues would you say designers or clothing companies face in selling people on these things? We have seen so much when it comes to food about anxiety, about artificial sweeteners, dyes, that kind of thing. A lot of that motivated by the so-called MAHA, Make America Healthy Again movement. Has any of that translated over into garments?
It really is. There's a lot of interest going into it. I tell students all the time, we spend a lot of time thinking about what we eat. Is it organic? But we don't pay as much attention to what we put on our body, which is covering the biggest organ of our body. And there's anecdotal evidence of some of those chemicals that we're using on natural or synthetic fibers, what we are absorbing in the skin. We don't know enough about it, but the research is certainly starting. It's an important consideration.
Based on what you know about all this, I mean, do you feel like there is any reason to hesitate about adopting some of these garments made out of, you know, wicking materials, phase-changing materials, or is it worth whatever the risk may be to be a little bit more comfortable, especially, you know, here in Arizona?
Wicking and most of these technologies we talked about is mechanical. It's not chemical. There is absolutely no risk for these. I don't doubt that there are some finishes somewhere that will make a difference, but wicking technology is not one of them. It's perfectly safe.
Okay. Okay. Well, that is Deborah Young, a clinical assistant professor of textiles science at ASU. Deborah, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And that'll do it for yet another cool edition of the show on this Tuesday. A reminder, for more cool stuff, you can follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ The Show. Also, you can sign up for the show's weekly newsletter. It is called Radiohead's A Fantastic Read. You can do that at tinyurl.com/theshowradioheads. The show was produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayanna Hamilton, as well as Bruce Drummond. Sky Shout is our digital editor, Chad Snow, the news director. The show was created by John Hoban. Our executive producer is Amy Silverman. For Sam Dingman, I'm Mark Brody here in Phoenix. Have a terrific rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow. That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.